Hi, I'm Jill Triplecock, and welcome to People's Internet Radio, Truth Broadcast Network, and Cancel the Cabal with Stephen Roberts. And Stephen Roberts is my producer. Hi, Stephen. Welcome.
Hi, Jill. How are you?
I'm well. How are you?
Very good.
I'm really looking forward to today's interview with my favorite person, Professor Twemlow.
How are you?
Hi, Stuart. How are you?
Good.
I'm so glad that we have you. There's no one in the world who knows as much about bullying as you do and the bystander effect. Just for anybody who's listening so they know, Stuart is a psychoanalyst and a psychiatrist, and that's what particularly impresses me, and that is the psychoanalytical approach. I think it's incredibly, psychoanalysis means a lot to me, because I think we all need to analyze ourselves, and a psychoanalyst is somebody who helps us analyze ourselves. And Stuart's gone from the position of not only analyzing his self and the psyche and also the psyche of others, but he's sort of spread that out to more of a social analysis and the psychodynamics of bullying. Stuart's been working for 40 years in communities researching and managing the causes of violence and ways to promote peace. And he's now working in consultations with schools, cities, corporations, the FBI and governments in third world countries. He's also on the teaching faculty at Houston, Texas for psychoanalytic studies. And he retired in 2011 from working as a senior psychiatrist at the Menninger Clinic and being the professor in the Department of Psychiatry at the Baylor College in Houston, Texas. And he's still a visiting professor at the University of London. And the list goes on and on. Stuart, there's so many wonderful things about your credentials here, and I've grown to know you over the last few interviews, and I'm still deeply impressed, and thank you for being here.
It's a pleasure.
Stuart, it's interesting. I do read a bit of your stuff, of course, and you were saying in terms of bullying and bullying in schools that people have an innate sense or realization of their fundamental right to belong to a group.
Yeah.
And that the meaning of disruptive behavior in young children is theorizing the child's, you theorize that the child's disturbing actions are based on his or her basic aim of achieving a place in the classroom group?
Absolutely.
Would you like to go on from there, please?
Yes.
Thank you so much.
My view of bullying is this, that when a child is bullying another child, what that represents is an attempt to get a membership of a social group that they belong to by performing a function the group wants. Now, you might say, well, why would a group want one child to bully another child? That's a good question. And I'm going to say what I think the reason for that is, because there is no doubt that bullying goes on. And bullying is part of what human beings have done since the caveman era. There's nothing new about it, and it's not an issue confined to a modern life at all. So here's the theory behind this socio-analytic view that motivates the work we do. The idea is that the bully is an agent of the system, and the victim is the product of what the system wants from the bully. The system wants a victim, and the bully becomes the agent of that system's wishes to have a product that represents how that child is no longer part of the system because they're sick. They need psychiatric care. They will become suicidal. They're not suitable in schools. Their academics are poor. Now, you'll notice alongside this that without being too dogmatic about it, the bully's academics are generally speaking within the normal range. The victim's academics are poor. So the bully then says, I have for you, the social system, a product that needs extrusion. Why don't we just get rid of it? Now, that child usually goes into therapy one way or the other, or drops out of school and gets a job, or drops out of school and does nothing. So the bully then is left as a successful agent of the social system. So he turns back to the social system and he says, okay, what are you going to do for me? And the social system says, you've done your job. You've created a bully, and that bully is not a good person to have in the system. And by the way, you aren't either, because you've been a little bit too violent. We don't like that. So we're going to kick you out of the system as well. And the bully then goes to special schools. He goes into out-of-school suspension. He goes into juvenile reformatories. He's labeled as a psychopath beyond redemption. And he starts to feel extremely angry. Now, then we're left with the social system. Now, who is that system? The system is, we call them bystanders. They're people that stand beside what's going on and watch it happen and make sure they keep their noses out of any trouble. It's sort of like somebody who doesn't want to be blamed for anything. They make sure that nobody blames them. And they say things like, well, I pay my taxes so teachers can teach and police can protect children, and so don't blame me. And you know, the bully had bad parents, don't blame me for that. So they sit there abdicating, and that term I think originally was applied to royalty, who abdicated a responsibility that the tradition of royalty required. It's like, I won't do that. And one of the English kings did that. He married a divorced woman. He had to abdicate his role. And we use the term abdicating because it's like a royal role. It's like, I'm in charge and you're going to do what I want. You teachers will teach, you police will protect, and we'll decide which bullies become the real bullies. Now, if that system remains that way, our theory is it gets stuck, because first of all, bullies won't put up with that for very long. There's plenty of bullies waiting for every one that's put in a special school. So many bullies will come up there, and at a certain point, the system represented by the principal becomes unable to function. The system becomes one in which the designated leaders become non-leaders. And the leadership is given to the children. And I'm going to give you an example of how that can be reversed in a minute. So a bully child becomes the leader of the school, and he projects to the school leaders that they are not functioning. Now, what happens then in that school? Teachers start to want to leave school early. They start taking mental health days. They start loathing any after-school activities they had to do. They want out of there as quickly as possible. They hate going to school. They take many mental health days. Now, you compare that with the school that's functioning well, and you'll see what I mean. There's a huge difference. The staff begins to pick up what in psychoanalysis we call projective identification, which is projecting into the staff the sickness of the school itself. And so staff don't want to be there. Sometimes it reaches an extreme degree I treated a woman, a teacher once, who hit a child, knocked him out. She was fired. And she'd brought up three children of her own and never, ever spanked them, let alone hit them. She said, I don't know what came over me. It was not me at all. It was like somebody else was using my body. And that school was a particularly violent, bully-dominated school. So our idea is the system is responsible for the failure of the school to become an environment within which children can learn peacefully. Unless the system is addressed, any number of anti-bullying programs will be a failure, as they have been worldwide. I think it's fair to say that America got into it real late, about 2005, but the rest of the world, particularly England and Scandinavia, have been doing research on bullying since the early 70s, and not a single program has been particularly effective. And I include here Dan Olvius, the Norwegian psychologist who's very well known. His best results are still poor.
And they don't transfer to American culture anyway. They're more successful over there than they are.
Absolutely. So nothing has been successful. We wrote a book called Why School Anti-Bullying Programs Don't Work. We think it's because the changes that are reported in science are not big enough to create an effect within the school that the parents and children and teachers notice. They're so minor that then might as well be nothing. So we had all this knowledge in the late 1990s. And so in 1999, we raised $1 million, amazingly, privately. I think it might have been the biggest private project ever done in the United States. And we took nine schools, elementary schools, and randomly assigned them to one of three conditions. One was they would have an intervention that focused not on the bully, not on the victim, but on the surrounding group, the bystander group. The second group would have what was typical of American psychiatry at the time, which was that a school psychiatrist, a child psychiatrist, would visit the school and see classes and see children in classes. They didn't have individual consultation. Then he would meet with the mental health team and discuss certain children that were problematic, and he or she would help with the referrals. So we had that too. And the third group had nothing except the promise of one of the other two groups after 2 years, whichever was most successful. So they were a motivated control group. And the upshot of it all was this. The experimental group that managed bystander participation, and that's all it did, how bystanders, children, teachers, administrators, volunteers, parents, community, mayor and city council, everybody in the school, involved with the school, participated in the school's welfare to manage the problem of bullying. That group did remarkably differently than the other two groups, hugely differently. The second group of psychiatric consultation did actually better than I thought they would do. They did something. I thought the results would probably wipe out, but they didn't. And the third group just got worse and worse and worse, because this particular city was in the middle of a surge of violence within the community itself. So those results were very striking. They were published in an extremely prominent psychiatric journal in 2009. And it was as close to proof as you could get. And I know you here don't want to go into the details of what proof is, but it was sort
evidence
of,
suggests.
strongly. And so he went straight from 2002 into working with bystanders. You know, when America was doing nothing, the rest of the world was working with bullies and victims trying to change their behavior, which of course worked well, except as soon as that work was finished, there were plenty of other bullies and victims waiting to take their place. Mm-hmm. And we started working with the idea that you needed to work with the whole school community and its complexities. And we did that, and we created a model based not on a program that you put in place, but a conceptual framework that you use to decide what your particular school needs, with the idea that every school needs something different. And in your country, Jill, that's modeled in CASI. That's what CASI has done. If you want to know about that, get hold of CASI. And they had, I think, a number of schools that were part of the original project, 12 or 14 schools. And they will show you what happened. Each school has its own particular way of managing bullying. Now, here's the other difference. We realize that an academic in a university does not know what goes on in a school. How can they design a program that works for the, for any school? So we abandoned that idea.
So true.
And all we did was say to the school, we'll give you a conceptual framework and we will make sure you understand it. Then you decide what you need for your school. And this implies that almost every school will be different. The idea that starts is teachers always say, you're the expert, tell us what to do. We say, we're not the expert, you tell us what to do. And that process goes on for about a year. Finally, teachers say, well, we know quite a bit. So let us think about what we need to do. Every school comes up with a viable program. And then we simply say, as long as it meets these criteria, which are outlined in what we say, and you may or may not have read our books, but
it's I've got a lot of just stuff off from Back Off Bully and the CASI links and networks, and
And so each school produces its own program, and we now have schools that have been 12 years doing this, that are highly successful. And one of the other things that we, and this is just a small point, but I'm going to make it because it's real important to how anti-bullying is managed in the United States at the moment. When we go into a school, by the time we leave the school in the sense of providing information, most of the school have forgotten who we are. I called a school we'd been in for 12 years, and it took quite a while before the program director remembered me. I was in, it was in another school in Jamaica where we'd been so undefined in our role, we were just defined as helpers, that when they would get when there was a presentation to be made to the media and the mayor, they said, what would we call you? And we said, whatever you want. And we were called artisans. is a sort of a skillful tradesman. Along with myself and a psychologist, and the third guy was a beachcomber who sold jewelry to tourists that we'd recruited to train the children. So we were all called artisans. They didn't see us in the role of advisor or expert. They saw us as facilitator. And that's how we think all school programs should be run, not from some massive thing from the federal government that works. Currently, this government in America is using a program called PBIS. The obvious program has faded out of popularity. But each school should have the option to create their own program. And we've done it in Australia, and we've done it in Hungary, and we've done it in Finland, we've done it in Jamaica, and we've done it in America in certain places that are able to say, we don't need you really. We know what to do.
We'd love that.
Your best job is to tell us that we have the knowledge. Now, this comes out of psychoanalysis.
Mm.
And I saw this as a very hugely different piece of what a treatment was. When I was a general surgeon, I didn't need anybody's cooperation as long as you lay still. I could open you up and cure your problem. What I realized in psychoanalysis is the patient owns the knowledge of how to solve their problem. I don't, as an analyst. I'm like a coach. I can keep them from going off the path, but they lead the ship. They steer it. And eventually they say, well, I know what we need. And then you say, well, what do you need? And the whole process goes on from there. So that's a very brief description of how psychoanalytic thinking applies to social issues. We're so used to having experts tell us what to do, we've forgotten that our own knowledge is extremely powerful.
Mm. Yes, it's very important. And so what you're saying there is that the schools, if they look deeply enough, will be able to identify what their problems are.
And we know it takes about a year for them to do that. They have to go through this process of, well, you're the expert, we're the ignorant, please tell us what to do. And we say, no, we're not the experts, you're the expert. And then we go through processes of, you know, well, let's imagine we're not an expert, what would you say you need to do? That whole process takes, we meet with them once every 2 weeks. And now, it takes about a year for a school to get enough self-esteem up to say, well, I really do think I know what we need to do.
With guidance, obviously. And do you use some sort of engineered sort of anxiety or engineered conflict in that too?
You know, if it's needed.
If it's needed, of course, there's no prescription.
Yeah, we have a what we call a toolbox. It's got 1,000 things in it. And if you want a martial arts program to help your school, we can help you. If you want an engineered conflict program to bring the community more in touch with your school, we can help you. But all of the requests for that stuff has to come from the school. First, they have to decide what it is they need to do to help their school.
Okay, so they actually get to know what's in your toolbox. Do you tell them, look, these are the options, so they can actually scan through those sort of ideas?
We do and we don't, Jill.
Mm-hmm.
If you think a school, I mean, we found there are, I think, 3 or 4 types of schools. There are schools with low motivation and very poor skill.
Mm-hmm.
We don't work with schools like that. They can't function. And then we have high motivation school, but low skill. They want something to change, but they don't have enough people and skill knowledge to do it. That's a hard school to manage. And then we have high motivation and high school, those schools are easy to manage because they're ready to train. So depending on how much time you have as a member of our group, you select the school that will respond most quickly.
That is really interesting, because that's exactly what, you know, that I have a big background in Tibetan Buddhism, and the sort of ideal student, you know, they say in Tibetan Buddhism there's three types of students. There's the devoted student that's really dumb, like with low intelligence.
Yeah.
And they sort of do okay. Because of the devotional aspect, and then there's the, well, I think they talk of the best one first. The best one is highly intelligent and high, you know, highly analytical and highly devoted. They're the best student.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because you've got, yeah. And then it goes down the scale, and then you, and but the worst student is the one that, well, actually, I don't know if I actually know what I'm talking about, because it's someone who, the one, I think one of the worst students is the one who can't settle on any one position. So I'm going to have to look it up and come back to you on that, because anyway, it's just, so I think, yeah, so you can't come to a conclusion, but you're better off to be dumb and devoted.
Yeah, as long as you have other...
Yeah, high motivation. So long as it's about motivation anyway.
Sure.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that is Tibetan Buddhism and schools meeting at this point around motivation, but you would be amazed at how extraordinary that would be looked at by American motivational psychologists. It's
really
amazing. But it comes from actually doing the work. If you do the work, you see that. And then you've got a way of shifting where you do what you do.
Mm. Well, what I'm really... Sorry.
Is the practical side of your work, how much time you have and who's available and so on and so forth, what your best bet is in terms of succeeding.
What you made me think of just before that I'd like to bring up in you, and that is the fact that you are a black belt in martial arts, and and you're very involved in the martial arts. And I actually watched a video, I don't know, it was in research of you, whether or not you said it, but it was about you anyway, and it was about martial arts and Cassie and... I thought that was really interesting that you do actually teach, not only just change the school culture to become protective of the of their own social climate, but also a lot of martial arts. Would you like to talk about the benefits of martial arts in schools?
Yes. In the toolbox. There's a whole program that you can use to start a martial arts training in your school. And we have, actually, of all the schools involved, not a high percent, but a percentage of the schools use martial arts. It's a choice.
Mm.
Now, what is involved with it is, for example... You would choose a martial arts approach if you had primarily boy bullying that was a major issue in your school. Because the evidence is martial arts best affects boys. And it best affects them not in reducing their aggressiveness, but in improving their helpful bystanding. In other words, they become less aggressive with other people who need them. For example, they don't become bullies, the so-called bully bystanders, which are the kids that stand around and cheer on the bully and make sure that he knows when the teacher's coming, and they stop, they fall out of that role, and they tend to adopt the role of protector of children on the playground. And if that's an issue, then a martial arts program is extremely important. However, you have to really be careful who you choose as the teacher. We've actually experimented with this, and the traditional teacher who comes in and teaches like Taekwondo will make no difference to your school whatsoever. The training has to be integrated with what the school is doing, which means that the martial arts trainer has to be part of the school. And we found it extremely helpful in schools where there's a lot of boy bullying, which in many schools that is the issue. Boys are more physical until high school. Then it all, of course, all changes.
That's interesting. So what you're sort of saying is that the character of the teacher, it seems what I'm getting out of that is you're saying that the teacher has to have a feeling of connection with the school too, and not lead the people off on a non-cohesive sort of tangent in some sort of ego sort of thing.
Absolutely. You're right. The teachers have to be in touch with all of this. It's not just an after-school program that your kids do.
Mm.
Teachers need to know why they're doing it, how they're doing it. What we suggest in a very detailed program is it's done. You don't even have to have martial arts experience. We can actually teach a PE teacher in about 2 hours what to do.
Really?
It's That's not good. Does not require a black belt, not at all.
So it's character.
It's character, and it's
yeah.
Right. It's roles, and you know, you practice roles, and you fight in certain ways. We teach children certain basic things that most people don't know. For example, how to fall without breaking your elbow or your wrist. I don't know if you've ever done that. Very, very common. People fall and they put their hand behind them and break a wrist, break an elbow. And there's a way of not doing that. And then we teach how do you deal with a body slam, which is a kid that, usually a big kid, sometimes fairly fat, comes up and slams your body against the wall. Or somebody that grabs you and pulls you off balance, either direction. And then we don't teach anybody to attack anybody, just to defend against the traditional ways people try and upset you. And they're so simple, you wouldn't believe it. And then we teach everybody bully, victim, bystander roles, so that bullies have to be victims and bystanders, and victims have to be bullies and bystanders. They all learn what it feels like to be in the role that they're complaining about is persecuting them. So
that is really interesting.
The role. Yeah.
That is incredibly powerful, because what you're saying is when you learn to put yourself in the other person's situation or to stand under somebody, then you can actually sort of dissolve the position.
Yeah, you become. I mean, finally, you would say you mentalize your bully. You begin to see that his actions are not based on the desire to hurt you; they're based on a misunderstanding of who you are.
Mm.
And then both the bully and the victim begin to understand that the whole situation becomes different. It's not a power struggle anymore; it's a matter of how you and he understand each other.
It's sort of interesting.
Examples of that.
Sorry, do go on.
We have 1,000 examples of kids who have come to know each other after getting through that first, you want to take my lunch money, you want to beat me up. No, I just want to know you. Okay, I want to know you too. So then they become best of friends.
Yeah, I've loved reading a couple of...
What did you say?
I've loved reading a couple of things that you said. You know, one of your solutions for somebody wants to take your lunch money, and you said, oh, so you want to take my lunch money? Well, that means you're hungry. You know, this is the sort of thing you said.
Yeah.
But I'm hungry too, so how about if I buy you lunch and we have lunch together?
That's a very good example. Yeah. And then what can the person say? come on, you know, I mean, there is a number of kids you say, oh, God damn you, I'll go and bully somebody else. But there are a lot of kids. We found about 3/4 of the children will say, interesting. Yeah, actually, why don't we have lunch?
I love that.
Yeah. See, kids in general don't want to fight.
Yeah.
They don't want the power struggle. That's what we found. And, you know, the other thing is bullies don't want the power struggle either. What they're looking for, they think they're looking for power. And they have power over, you know, all their followers and their big bad bullies. But they cannot buy friendship.
Hmm.
Even Saddam Hussein realized that. He couldn't buy friends. He could buy compliance. He could buy submission. He could buy power over everybody. But he could not buy a friend. And many a bully has said to us, I am so happy having friends.
Mm.
You know? That's what a bully cannot have. By comply, by forcing people to comply through the use of power.
That's so right, true. And
many, many bullies who are in families where they're often misunderstood. They may be the object of violence from parents or abuse from parents. And often the best experience they have is at school, where they can actually be role models and they can have friends who like them.
Mm.
So, I mean, I could give you 1,000 examples of kids that have said to their parents, the best part of my day is going to school. That's where I like it. And I think I told you the example of the, we had a very bad kid. He was, you know, educable, mentally retarded. I think he was on 200 milligrams of Adderall, which is almost lethal. And he'd set his mother's car on fire and broken all her windows out and urinated all over her furniture. And she had, you know, 14 children by 14 different fathers, and he was one of them. And he just loved being in the school, being in the program. And the martial arts trainer picked him up each day from his home. He was the first one out of bed. He took his Ritalin, and he was out there waiting to go to school. And finally, his mother said, how come you want to go to school? I never heard of a kid who wants to go to school. And he said, I like school. Well, in school, he'd had this special arrangement where he could go to the principal, sit in his office for 5 minutes, leave, no discussion, whenever he felt out of control. So to cut a long story short, his mother came to the school and had an appointment with the principal and said, why does he want to go to school? He's hated school. And the principal said, well, you know, he's a kid who's very involved with the martial arts program, and he's become a leader in his classroom. And she said, interesting. So this woman, you know, if you look at her, she had knife cuts all over her face. She was, you know, 300 pounds in weight on Medicaid, Australia sort of welfare. But she said, can I see what you're doing in a school? And she came in and sat around, and she had skills with computers. She was actually a very intelligent woman. So there was a program in the school called Parents as Teachers. And so she stayed in the school and began to become a parent teacher. And her son began to improve. Cut a long story short, he just graduated from the University in Ohio with a bachelor's degree, a science degree. He has a 140 IQ. His mother manages a Walmart in Ohio. And
fantastic.
So she's making a very good income. Neither of them are on welfare.
Yeah.
that's how a school turned around that family, where a child got the parent into the treatment, if you can call it treatment.
Yeah, that's really interesting. That actually marries the two ideas that I've got in my head. One is before, when you were talking about the boy who did the body slam, and I'm pretty sure it was in America. It might have been Australia, but it must have been a long time ago, because it's when I had a television. But everybody was making this big sort of fuss over how this fat guy had body slammed this boy, and all these revolting responses from the public who were saying things like, get him back, and good on you for getting him back, and and there was a lot of sort of praising and sort of encouraging him to be violent, this young boy who'd done a violent reaction to the body slam, and I was horrified. And then that, with you saying engineering this sort of, I'd like you to make a comment on that in a minute, and then also marry that with the idea of changing the culture of the school, and also including families, and how that is empowering for everyone.
Well, you've raised a very big question, but it's a very important question, Jill. A child who sees that an attack on them is a sign of weakness in the attacker.
Yeah.
Weakness would be defined as insecurity. It's like the attacker cannot defend himself, so he just lashes out. And the defender has learned some techniques to deflect the attack and render the attacker not necessarily useless, but not able to be effective. At a certain point, he can say to the attacker, "What is your problem?" I can't give you an example from schools, but I can from my personal experience, where I've been attacked from behind, and I've never, ever, ever once had to attack somebody physically that I could talk to. Only somebody attacks me from the back and I don't see them and I have to react to them. And I'd reacted to this guy who was drunk, and I caught his head before it hit the sidewalk. Had it hit the sidewalk, he would have had a fractured skull. And after I got him around, it took him a while to wake up. He was fairly drunk as well as, hurt.
Yeah, I love that story.
Why did you do that? And I said, because you would have had a skull bleed. You would have bled in your brain and probably died. And he said, yeah, but I attacked you. And I said, yeah, I know. That's not your fault. You're a guy with a lot of problems, aren't you? And he said, well, yes, I am. Cut a long story short, we had a half-hour talk in the pub, and I bought him a meal and sent him off to a colleague who'd see people on Medicaid for nothing. And, that's an example of I don't take, and a good kid in the school who's trained in martial arts doesn't take it personally. It's like the attacker is got a defect. And you have to be understanding of that and say, I've said this more than once to people, not in this country, but in other countries. If you want to rob me, ask me. I'll give you more money than you deserve. Take it from me and I'll hurt you. It's as simple as that. And so the kids in the martial arts piece of this program learn that their skill enables them to be gentle with the attacker. And that changes the attacker immensely.
Mm. So what advice do you have to...
That I find interesting. Very few schools have adopted the martial arts program because they think it somehow means violence.
Well, that's right. It's only recently that I've cottoned on to it, because I actually was, you know, doing a lot of research, and yeah. I was going, oh, now I understand why this martial arts, how it can really work, and it is worth people considering, or I'd like to draw attention to it. And also, because children are so physical, it's the same as, you know, often over the years I've been handed psychotic people, like particularly when I was a Buddhist nun. And you'd always end up with some sort of loony in the monastery. And the lamas would always come and get me. And I'd think, why do they keep giving me? Anyway, so I got to know a lot of sort of people who were spinning out and over the years, like endlessly. And I realized, and especially if they want to follow a spiritual path, and I kept saying, you really need to go and do some sort of Hindu yoga or something. This mind trip doesn't really work for you. You need to do something physical with this.
You can.
Yeah. And it seems like the same with yoga, martial arts, because kids are so young and so physical and, you know, they're so young. Yeah. And
particularly elementary school students, they love it.
Yeah, they would.
It has to do with the fact the martial artist is big and strong and is little, of course. Most of them are short people. And, you know, the parents are big and huge and tall, and the little guy can overcome the big guy. By the time you get to middle and high school, that's not so popular anymore. That's where you get into, you know, you have to use techniques around sports. Mm-hmm. That's something we haven't even talked about. The whole issue of coaching sport and how you coach it, really important, especially in football and basketball. And then later in high school, you've got the whole matter of intellectual tradition.
All these different ways that you can get self-esteem and power and respect.
But the school teachers have to be willing to orient what they do to managing power issues and managing how you understand and reflect on the needs of the person you're fighting. They're not really enemies. They're people that are part of your community. And when you beat them, you better beat them in a way that doesn't injure them very badly, or that they can handle without being too angry with you or something like that.
Well, I love that story, how you grabbed that attacker and then protected his head as he fell to the ground.
Children do the same thing. They say to people, you know, I don't want to hurt you. Please don't do this.
Yeah.
And it happens. And so, you know, I think martial arts has a role in managing the flagrant use of physical violence in our culture.
Yeah.
But I would wish that we wouldn't need to use it, except in the sense of what we've talked as the gentle warrior.
I love that term, gentle warrior. I love it. I like the term spiritual warrior, and I like the word gentle warrior. And I see you as a warrior, too. I told you I had a dream about you dressed as a warrior. So I do like warrior, the spiritual warrior and the gentle warrior. I think I've always known that you've called the upstander the gentle warrior. And we only have about another 10 or 15 minutes. Would you like to talk about the upstander as the gentle warrior a bit longer, Stuart?
Yeah. Is that
a good point?
The idea that a safe child, or a happy child, or a child who's an upstander, cannot also do martial arts is a mistaken idea. In many ways, an upstander should be able to do martial arts, because it will improve their skill on upstanding. What martial arts does is best captured in Nietzsche's saying about his Superman. He said, the Superman needs to be a Roman soldier, Roman Caesar, with Christ's soul.
Mm.
And it and when somebody attacks you at a certain level of skill, you say, I wish you would not do that.
Mm.
It's a true feeling of compassion.
Yeah.
And if you have to do it, I mean, my way of handling it, my family's, is you do the minimum amount to hurt a person.
Yeah.
You make sure they don't kill themselves.
Yeah.
And so the gentle warrior is a person who can take care of themselves physically, at the same time are mentally gentle and trying to let everybody know that what they do that's physical is in the service of being gentle. The true warrior is a protector. I've had experience with that, Jill. I've been invited to many conferences in a very funny way. They invite me not so much to the conference, but to protect it. It's like, would you mind just making sure everybody's okay? Would you mind, you know, patrolling the boundaries at night? Would you mind making sure you're up in the morning to make sure everybody's okay? And then they are, you know, they say, well, you know, and of course you can come to everything you want to and so on and so forth. But I'm there primarily to protect them. And the warrior concept, there actually is a movie that captures this well. It's a true martial arts movie. The warrior, in the gentle sense, is attached only to protection. He's not attached to family. He's not attached to wife. He's not attached to anything but protection. He protects people. That's his primary task.
And there's your upstander, your bystander.
That's your upstander, except, we obviously don't invite children to not have a wife or not, I mean, not be an ordinary person. When I said upstander in the martial arts sense, I was talking about the true martial artist.
Okay, yeah. Okay,
That's his role.
Right.
He has no family, no friends, no wife, no children. His role is protection. The best example of it is the UN peacemakers. There has to be people like that in the world. That's what a lot of pacifists don't really see. There must be protection, whatever system you live under.
Mm.
Many of us, doesn't have to be, but I think it's, you need somebody to patrol the boundaries and make sure everybody's safe.
Mm. I'm just in my mind, I so agree with this. In my mind, I'm trying to tie this in because I'm trying to tie the end of this conversation into the beginning. Yeah. So that's what's actually going through my mind. And I'm thinking the beginning of the conversation was about the psychoanalytic approach to this. And so I'm actually trying to like, it's in terms of protecting your own mind, and then in your way you're protecting your own spirituality, your own goodness, your own happiness, and your own mental health.
And
as
you
well.
See it within the idea of safety of your community, your family, your population, your neighborhood.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
that's fundamental. The rest of this discussion, millions of discussions we could have on politics, or this, is irrelevant.
Yeah.
It's all about family, friends, and neighborhood.
Yeah, and it's back to the grassroots. And this is this other thing. I was thinking about your conversation with Fonagy, and I was thinking about Jaimel Schacht, and I always forget the other word, but you know those two German words about top-down and all the different ways. And I actually decided the answer is it's all. You're both right.
Yeah.
You can't take one position.
No.
It has to be both. If you both go to, you know, if it's external Yeah. So
and you see, there's never any answer. I mean, we're always so worried about getting an answer. There's no answers. They're just questions.
Yes.
You can't live with that. I mean, your life is pretty awful.
Yeah, well, there's always many, many questions, and there's always many, many, many answers. But there's a fabulous book written by a woman who's married to a Tibetan Lama. I've been reading it. It's in my bedroom, but anyway, it's called The Power of the Open Question. And yeah. That is, there's always a new question. There's always a question.
Yeah.
Just endless questions. So, you're going to be out here in April or something, aren't you? Are you doing any Cassie events?
No, I'm not next year, most likely.
Okay, so...
That's partly because Cassie has had trouble with funding and...
Oh, have they?
They have, yeah.
Well, it might be worth directing people to both. There's a Facebook page called Back Off Bully, which I'd sort of like to plug at the moment. And also, while I'm into plugging things, I have to remind people who are on people internet radio to please press the donate button. But I think you have to do something after just pressing a button. I don't think just pressing a button will be enough.
I think you have to come out there. It's just a matter of if somebody can pay. I don't mind talking to your guys, but I'm short of money.
Right. Yeah, no, we don't. I mean, I'm just thinking, you know, Cassie really sort of enjoys promoting you.
They did. They were very good, but they've reached a level of funding where they're downgrading both programs, the Aboriginal one and the Cassie Peaceful Schools one. They're in the final phases of that. Cassie Peaceful Schools ends at the end of this year, funding-wise, and the Aboriginal program ends at the end of 2016. So my role in terms of starting up, getting people moving, getting everything going, is over. My role now is consultant to them as needed. So it doesn't involve visiting them every year.
Yeah. Oh, well, that's okay. Well, they're doing quite a good job. I mean, 12 schools is getting to be quite a lot.
Yeah.
They
have lots of other schools that are joining up and paying, and I think it's quite a successful program, but the problem is getting me out there would cost him a lot of money.
Well, that's right. It's a long way to Tipperary. So I'm just thinking how schools are always struggling. You were saying in terms of cyberbullying, you don't really, I don't really want to go, we won't go there at this end of the...
We can. I mean, that's a whole area in itself, if you want to.
Yeah, I wouldn't mind looking at that. But I've got a document in front of you about the initial consultation meeting and observations in the classroom and instructional arrangements, teaching styles and strategies, target students' work behaviour, participation, emotional behaviour, nature of the interaction. I mean, every one of these is a paragraph. And obviously, you know, a whole 5-minute conversation in itself.
Yeah.
Stephen, when you're picturing...
I'm okay. I mean, cyberbullying I know about, and, you know, they're actually our first project, major research project, and it started in 1999, was dedicated to a child who hung himself after the beginning of instant message, and he had been bullied at a particular high school, and his mother, who was a school counselor, moved him to another school, and instant message started, and he continued to be bullied by instant message and eventually hung himself. So our randomized trial is dedicated to him. That's in the very early days of cyberbullying.
Okay, well, it seems we've got longer than we thought we had, because Stephen's been sending me around and got confused. Stephen, you have to comment, Stephen.
Yeah, I know. I was sitting here looking at different things, and I didn't read the clock correctly. And you got plenty of time.
Stephen did this to me twice today, Stuart. He knew I had, because I've been doing lots of shows, I did 7 hours of radio the other day. Oh, and wow. I ended up doing one in the middle of the night for 2 hours. And anyway, so my sleeping clock's got changed around a bit. So last night I had very few hours sleep.
Yes,
he notices and he rings me an hour and a half before I have to talk to you.
Yeah.
And I'm saying to him, why have you woken me up an hour and a half before I have to go on air?
But Jill, you have to realize I do about 7 hours of radio a night.
I know. I don't know how you do it. It was enough for me in one day. Yeah, so Stephen's just into...
Troopers, I must say, you troopers. So let's decide we've worked through enough of this to where this went on okay. You got a sort of an outline of a bullying theory. You may be interested to know that both my books on bullying are being read by a journalist who writes for the New York Times.
Oh, I'm very interesting to know that. And in fact, yeah, go on.
Out at some time. She's a journalist who received awards for her journalistic skill.
Yes.
And she's taken on my two books. And then I'm going to talk to her, so there will be some... Because what I've said to you about bullying is not what the majority of experts will say to you. I've given you a view of bullying based on my own work.
Well, absolutely, exactly. And Stuart, what are the names of both of your books?
The first book
I should say Professor Twemlow at this point.
Bullying programs don't work.
Why bullying... repeat the title, sorry.
Why school anti-bullying programs don't work.
By Stuart W. Twemlow.
And Frank Sacco.
S-A-C. And Frank Sacco.
That's published by Roman and Littlefield. They have an imprint of Jason Aronson. It was published in 2008. And the second book is called Preventing School Bullying and Violence. It was published by the American Psychiatric Press. And I'm not 100% sure. I think it was 2012. By myself and Frank Sacco.
And published, you're gone.
American Psychiatric Press.
So it's a really good book. They're both really, really good books that people should get.
Well, the first book is for teachers, intelligent parents, school administrators, and people who work at school. The second book is for researchers and academics who want to understand how and why bullying occurs in schools.
I'm just writing them down to repeat them at the end of the interview, actually. Professor Twemlow, do you want to tell me the name of the second title again, even though I know it's on your back off bully page?
Yeah, Preventing Bullying and School Violence.
That's right. And they still keep talking about it, and they still keep wanting people to... it's still a riddle, and it's sort of a bit of a riddle to me how it can be a bit of a riddle.
Yeah.
In a way.
Yeah.
You know, why can't we just get on top of it? And it is, I think, one thing from a sociological point of view is I think it's so important to actually to train the community.
Yeah.
Have you... And I just wonder how to capture the community, and I'm thinking maybe you have to go through community radio or something like that.
That, although, you know, I mean, again, if we're lucky, we will get a Center for Disease Control, which is a major federal funding agency in America,
right,
to give us several million dollars to work on a way of managing very serious violence in Hispanic youth in Miami, in Puerto Rico, and all the way up the West Coast. I mean, excuse me, all the way up the East Coast of America. And that the methodology that is unique is to do it in a way that creates a context within which violence is not possible.
Right, and so that's about that's a cultural context, obviously.
Yeah, and we don't work on treating violent children or managing, you know, or looking for excuse me, attributes of violence. We create communities within which violence wouldn't really work. You were violent, you would look like a fool.
Mm. And that's very interesting, because how do you sort of, would you like to comment on, do you need a glass of water?
No, I'm fine.
Okay. On training the importance, would you like to just make sort of some really strong comments on the power of the bystander? Why training the bystander is more powerful than training the victim or the perpetrator?
I will comment on that. The bystander controls the way in which the victim-victimizer relationship works. For example, if a bystander says or does an action that tells the victim and victimizer that what they're doing is not acceptable and not liked and won't be tolerated, then that process will stop.
Mm. And why is that?
Because the bystander represents you, me, Steve, and everybody else. In other words, the school as a whole. If the school as a whole says, stop it, we don't want this in our school, then the bystander exerts massive influence on the bully and victim that are acting out their own dynamics. And it will stop.
Mm.
The fact is, this is not one bystander coming up and getting in the face of the bully.
Mm.
It's 20 bystanders getting in the face of the bully and saying, stop this.
Mm.
We don't do it this way in our school.
Mm.
This is how we do it.
Mm.
Little by little, the school bully gets no social capital from being a bully. We had a system in which the bullies started wearing T-shirts that said, be kind and gentle.
Mm. I love that.
That's social capital.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's really cool.
It's you a damn thing. The thing here is you change the social capital. You change what kids get out of being a bully. If you have a school, give you an example. I'm working in a city now with affluent, white, wealthy schools where bullying is rampant. And one father who was an attorney, a very prominent attorney, decided to invite a whole bunch of children to a local pub. And he gave all the boys beer. And then one of the mothers complained, and he said, hell, man, they're just becoming men. Why shouldn't they drink beer? Now, these are affluent, middle-class people. Mm. That particular guy had a very serious alcohol problem, known to me. He was spreading his sick influence around the school in a way that was very unhealthy. And this man made many millions of dollars every year, Jill.
Mm.
He's not a poor black man with no income.
Mm.
He was a very wealthy white man with enormous income. Mm. And so, see, to solve the issue of where the social capital comes
mm.
does not require us to function, to focus only on poor people. The wealthy mm. are actually worse at it, I think. I may be wrong, but who knows?
You're saying that the wealthy are worse at...
Promote,
would you like to...
They're worse at promoting guerrilla tactics like beat your chest and be a real man and drink a beer when you're 10 years of age. Got it?
Yeah, I've got it. I've got it. I've got it. I've got it. My mind's sort of trying to make sure that I've got it, and I've got it. So I'm just sort of... I've got an agenda happening in my head here, which was how to tie it back to the beginning. So that pretty well does it. This is, so it's just back to the innate sense of realization of one's fundamental right to belong to the group. That's sort of how we began, and yeah. and that's what you're saying. And so it's really up to...
You cannot be a father figure with great influence over the school because you're a famous attorney who makes millions of dollars a year. You cannot be in the role of promoting alcohol. It's
absolutely
not that there's anything wrong with alcohol. I drink. I'm sure you drink. We all drink. I'm not saying we all need to be teetotalers. Mm-hmm. I'm just saying that when you have an important social function
mm.
with children, they listen to you.
Mm.
And when you promote alcohol, you are doing something that will ruin them.
That's such a crazy thing to do.
Very good and a very positive wine drinker.
Mm.
See what I'm saying?
Yeah, I get you.
It's alcohol. It's the role of the parent in this process.
Oh. Yeah, I mean, when you said it to me, I was sitting there in horror. I was thinking, how absolutely ridiculous, you know, that you should try and get kids to go and drink. I mean, really, I think if you want children to drink, you should start at about 10 and give them a thimbleful, because by the time they're at 17, their brains are so crazy that they don't really, you know, like, would they make it a big deal and it becomes a culture and they kill themselves with this alcohol. And I really, really don't like that.
But if you are a major figure, like this guy was, he was not just an ordinary attorney.
Yeah.
He was a very famous attorney. He needs to know that the impact of his views have enormous effect on children's thinking.
Yeah, absolutely. And the bystanders, being the children and the parents, should be all going to him, and that's what you're doing now.
Right.
Yep, and we're saying it's not cool to teach kids to drink. And Stuart Twemlow,
yes.
Thank you. You are my teacher. Thank you so much for teaching me.
Pleasure.
And the teacher of so many people who are listening. We're so lucky to have you. And Stuart Twemlow, thank you very much.